Thank you all for coming today. We will continue looking at the sixth seal of the book, that the scroll that Jesus opens in the book of Revelation. I wanted to read Isaiah 62, where it says in Isaiah 62, verse 6, about Jerusalem and about our need to pray for Jerusalem. It says, I have set watchmen upon thy walls, O Jerusalem, which shall never hold their peace, day nor night. Ye that make mention of the Lord, keep not silence, and give him no rest, till he establish, until he make Jerusalem a praise in the earth. And we definitely need to pray for Jerusalem, our home, and that it shall come down soon out of heaven and establish the peace that we all look forward to. Let's open to Psalm 147 as our first psalm, Psalm 147a. You'll notice the second stanza mentions Jerusalem. The Lord builds up Jerusalem, brings back her captive sons. He binds up all their wounds and heals the brokenhearted ones. Ultimately, we see the psalm fulfilled in the New Jerusalem, and when he brings back the captives, Israelites from the far-off lands, and gathers them back in their home country of Israel, in their capital city of the New Jerusalem, with Christ. So let's sing together Psalm 147a. Let's turn in our Bibles to Revelation chapter 6 again. We have spoken about first five seals, and now we come again to the sixth one. And we've already explained that this is the beginning of the sixth seal at the end of chapter 6. It goes through chapter 7 as well. But this is a description, statements of what's going to happen at the second coming of Christ as we read the sixth seal in Revelation chapter 6. Beginning with verse 12 again. And I beheld when he had opened the sixth seal, and lo, there was a great earthquake, and the sun became black as sackcloth of hair, and the moon became as blood, and the stars of heaven fell unto the earth, even as a fig tree casteth her untimely figs when she is taken of a mighty wind. And the heaven departed as a scroll when it is rolled together, and every mountain and island were moved out of their places. And the kings of the earth, and the great men, and the rich men, and the chief captains, and the mighty men, and every bondman, and every free man, hid themselves in the dens and in the rocks of the mountains, and said to the mountains and the rocks, Fall on us, and hide us from the face of him that sitteth on the throne, and from the wrath of the Lamb, for the great day of his wrath has come, and who shall be able to stand? And may the Lord bless the reading of his word to our hearts today. Let's begin by going back to Hebrews chapter 12. Hebrews chapter 12. We have been discussing the great earthquake that shakes not only earth, but also heaven itself. And that is certainly the most unique part of this earthquake, how it brings about the new heavens and new earth. We talked about Christ's words in Matthew and Luke, also Mark, as he connects the great event of the sixth seal and the shaking of heaven and earth to the second coming of Christ, and the sun and moon being darkened at that time as well. And then we also looked at Romans chapter 8, Paul describing the creation as it goes through its birth pangs, which well describes the earthquakes of the earth, if not other natural disasters that occur, tsunamis and hurricanes and so forth. But the earth, the birth pangs that build up and up and up, until the day of the birth. We saw in Romans 8 that was connected to the day of the adoption of the sons of God, their resurrection, which certainly fits into our understanding of the second coming and Matthew 24 and what Christ says there about the day of his coming. We also saw that in 2 Peter chapter 3, that is also the day of the fire that comes down to bring forth the new heavens and new earth. And so Romans 8, as it speaks about the birth pangs, may be expressing how the earth, the grave, so to speak, like a womb, the children of God are born, transformed, and resurrected out of the womb, out of the grave, kind of as a mother gives birth to her children. So maybe the birth pangs related to the birth of the sons of God, which is definitely in that passage. But it may also be just in relation to its own rebirth, as the creation is freed from its burdens and corruption and its futility to be brought forth as the new heavens and new earth, and therefore born again in a sense as well. So maybe the birth pangs relate to that. Neglected to mention Matthew 24, where it says that there will be famines and wars and rumors of wars and so forth, that is the beginning of sorrows. The word sorrows there actually is a word for birth pangs. So that is the beginning of the birth pangs. We are seeing more and more of those birth pangs even today as we wait for Christ's second coming. So as we are here in Hebrews chapter 12, let's look again at the words of Paul here when it says, verse 25, "See that ye refuse not him that speaketh, for if they escaped not who refused him that spake on earth, much more shall not we escape if we turn away from him that speaketh from heaven, whose voice then shook the earth," at Mount Sinai, "but now he hath promised, saying, yet once more I shake not the earth only, but also heaven. And this word, yet once more, signifieth the removing of those things that are shaken, as of things that are made, that those things which cannot be shaken may remain. Wherefore, we receiving a kingdom which cannot be moved, let us have grace whereby we may serve God acceptably with reverence and godly fear, for our God is a consuming fire." So in verse 26 again, "Yet once more I shake not the earth only, but also heaven." Very clearly, this shaking of heaven is a one-time event. And so as we look into the Old Testament today, we will take the very basic principle of interpretation that any passage that describes the shaking of heaven must be referring to the second coming of Christ, the day of the Lord, the day of this shaking of heaven and earth, because, as Paul clearly says here, this is yet once more to happen. The prior earthquake was at Mount Sinai, and then only another situation resulting from the voice of Christ would result in the shaking of earth, but not only earth, but also heaven. And so any passage that speaks to the shaking of heaven must refer to this great earthquake to come. I think that's a very simple logic to understand. And so let's go into the Old Testament today and see some of these passages that refer to the shaking of heaven. Let's go to Haggai chapter 2. Haggai chapter 2. Keep your finger, I should have said this sooner, sorry. Keep your finger in Hebrews chapter 12. But let's turn to Haggai chapter 2. We start here in Haggai because that is the passage that Paul is clearly referring to. Haggai chapter 2. Haggai was a contemporary with Zechariah. They too were the prophets of God that spoke and encouraged the Israelites that came back from the 70 years of captivity. Encouraged them to build the temple of the Lord. And as we see in chapter 1, Haggai begins writing in the second year of Darius the king, in the sixth month, the first day of the month, That's Haggai 1:1. Now you turn to Haggai chapter 2, and you'll notice it's just a month later in the seventh month, on the 21st day of the month, that he gives this prophecy in Haggai chapter 2. The verse that we particularly want to get down to is verse 6. This is the verse that Paul refers to, where it says in verse 6, "For thus saith the Lord of hosts, yet once, it is a little while, and I will shake the heavens and the earth and the sea and the dry land." If you still have Hebrews chapter 12, you look back at the words of Paul in Hebrews 12, verse 26, it says, "Whose voice then shook the earth, but now he hath promised, saying, yet once more I shake not the earth only, but also heaven." You'll notice he's not quoting Haggai word for word, but nevertheless gives the proper meaning of Haggai chapter 2, verse 6. So for Haggai and Zechariah, they are encouraging the people of God, the Israelites, to build the temple. The Israelites have built their own houses, but have neglected building the temple like they should have done. And so Haggai and Zechariah are encouraging Zerubbabel and also Joshua to lead the people in the building of the temple. And so chapter 2, they've gotten started, and we'll begin in verse 1. "In the seventh month, in the 1 and 20th day of the month, came the word of the Lord by the prophet Haggai, saying, Speak now to Zerubbabel, the son of Shealtiel, governor of Judah, and to Joshua, the son of Jozadak, the high priest, and to the residue of the people, saying, Who is left among you that saw this house in her first glory? And how do you see it now? Is it not in your eyes in comparison of it as nothing?" So at the very beginning, we see a comparison of the great, glorious temple that Solomon built by the direction of God, as God gave the instructions to David, and David passed them to his son Solomon. A great and glorious temple, but in comparison, the one that Zerubbabel's generation is building, it's not to be compared as far as glory. But that prepares us for what he's going to prophesy about the temple yet to come. Verse 4, "Yet now be strong, O Zerubbabel, saith the Lord, and be strong, O Joshua, son of Jozadak, the high priest. And be strong, all ye people of the land, saith the Lord, and work. For I am with you, saith the Lord of hosts. According to the word that I covenanted with you when you came out of Egypt, so my spirit remaineth among you. Fear ye not. For thus saith the Lord of hosts, yet once it is a little while, and I will shake the heavens and the earth, the sea and the dry land. I will shake all nations, and the desire of all nations shall come, and I will fill this house with glory, saith the Lord of hosts." And so the comparison was made again between the house that they were building and the glorious temple of Solomon, and it was not comparable. But now he prophesies that his spirit is with them, so be strong, and that it is a little while, and there's going to be a shaking of heaven and earth, which is the great shaking that we talked about already. And the nations will be shaken in verse 7, and the desire of all nations shall come. Need to explain that phrasing a little bit there. The shaking of all nations certainly will result when the whole heavens and earth are shaken at the same time. But then it speaks about the desire of all nations shall come. The Hebrew actually will indicate that the subject of the verb there, that who is coming, is plural. It's not the desire of the nation of all nations that shall come. It's more that they shall come to the desire of all nations. So as they are shaken, they shall fall, and in falling, They will be brought to submission under Christ, and they will come to the desire of all nations. This phrase, the desire of all nations, is wondered about and debated as to what it refers to. Some refer it to the temple that's there, but again, the description of its glory for Zerubbabel's temple certainly doesn't fulfill what's prophesied about that temple. Some would say that it refers to Jesus Christ, that he is the desire of all nations, and certainly he is the desire of all nations. And we can look at John's gospel, especially the writings of John, that Jesus is very clearly the temple. He is the Bethel, the house of God, which angels shall ascend and descend over him, a reference back to what happened with Jacob and how he saw the staircase or the ladder with angels ascending and descending and called the place Bethel, house of God. Christ also said that if you destroy this temple, I will rebuild it in 3 days, and the apostles recognized and understood that he referred to the temple, which is his own body, and that in dying he would be raised from the dead, resurrected on the third day, and so the temple refers to him. And then in Revelation, also written by John, we see at the very end of the book of Revelation that there is no temple structure in the New Jerusalem, but God and the Lamb are its temple. And so in a very real sense, Christ himself is the temple. And so they would understand that Christ then is the desire of all nations. I would suggest a third option, that the desire of all nations actually refers to the New Jerusalem, which is to come. That when the nations are shaken in the shaking of the heavens and the earth, then they will come to the New Jerusalem, the desire of all nations. Many prophecies are told about Israelites that are brought to the New Jerusalem in that day when Christ returns. So the return of the Israelites, the captives, as we sang in Psalm 147. But it also speaks about the nations, that they will submit to Christ, the coastland shall wait for his law, and that they will actually put the Israelites on their shoulders and carry them to the glorious Jerusalem that is then present. And so they come to the desire of all nations. Why is Jerusalem a desire of all the nations? It's certainly not the desire of all nations right now, although we could maybe argue that the Arabs want to claim it and conquer it. Still is not the desire of all the nations that it one day shall be. Ultimately, it becomes the desire of all nations because of its great glory. It's very large, 1,400 miles square. It's very wealthy, and of course, as they are forced to submit to Christ's reign, they come to submit themselves in his presence there at the New Jerusalem. So it becomes the desire of all nations in many aspects. There is no city to be compared to it. We sing of the glory of New York City and of London and of other cities, but when the New Jerusalem comes down, it will not only cover cities, it will cover states because it's so large, and there will be no city like it. It will be so glorious, it will be the desire of all nations. So let's turn to Psalm 48, verse 2 in our Bibles. Psalm 48, verse 2. Notice the description that's given here. We'll read verse 1, get us started. Psalm 48, verse 1. Great is the Lord, and greatly to be praised in the city of our God, in the mountain of his holiness. Beautiful for situation, the joy of the whole earth. is Mount Zion on the sides of the north, the city of the great king. God is known in her palaces for a refuge. She is called here the joy of the whole earth. The joy of the whole earth. And now let's also turn to Lamentations chapter 2. Lamentations chapter 2. Lamentations is written by Jeremiah following the fall of Jerusalem to Babylon. And it is a lamentation. It's a weeping and sorrowing over the loss of Jerusalem and the devastation that has come to Jerusalem. But notice how ironically we find here a verse about the glory of the city. Lamentations 2 verse 15 says, "All that pass by clap their hands at thee. They hiss and wag their head at the daughter of Jerusalem, saying, Is this the city that men call the perfection of beauty, the joy of the whole earth?" And so Jerusalem that is now is far from the glory that it shall shine forth when it comes down out of heaven and is placed here on the earth, the new Jerusalem, the reborn Jerusalem. It one day will be the joy of the whole earth, the perfection of beauty, but it is not today. When it does come, though, as Haggai describes it, it will be the desire of all nations. There will be nothing more glorious than that city, and all will recognize and give praise to the great city that God has created, not man. And so with that understanding, we go back to Haggai chapter 2, verse 7. "I will shake all nations," and with the changing of the translation, "they shall come to the desire of all nations," which is the city, "and I will fill this house, this temple, with glory, saith the Lord of hosts." And so for me, at least, this passage becomes a very significant connection between the city of Jerusalem and the temple. This house, in comparison, in contrast to Solomon's temple that he built, and the one that they were building even on the day they received this prophecy. But this house, this desire of all nations, this new Jerusalem, shall be the house or the temple that God fills with glory. And truly a great, glorious city that will be. Verse 8, he says, "The silver is mine and the gold is mine, saith the Lord God of hosts." God claims the wealth of this world. He rightly does, as Psalm 24 says, "The earth is the Lord's and the fullness thereof, the world and all who dwell therein." As Revelation and Isaiah teach us, they will bring the wealth of the nations to the city, to Christ, as he reigns over the nations, as they pay tribute to him. And so, the silver is mine, the gold is mine, God claims it all. And then verse 9, "The glory of this latter house," referring to the city, "shall be greater than of the former, saith the Lord of hosts. And in this place will I give peace, saith the Lord of hosts." The great prophecy of the peace of Jerusalem. We could look at Isaiah chapter 11, where the child can play on the hole of the snake's hole and not be bit, that he could lie down with the lion and not be hurt at all. And nothing shall be hurt or destroyed on his holy mountain. In this place there will be peace. And he will bring peace to all the nations as he turns their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks and brings about a worldwide peace. And so, understanding these things, I think, very clearly puts this passage in connection with the second coming of Christ and the new Jerusalem that is to come. And even without those connections, we must say that Paul clearly understands in Hebrews 12 that this shaking of heaven and earth is related to something yet still future. It will only happen once, and we see the connection with the day of the Lord in the New Testament. So recognizing that, let's notice that there's one more verse to consider here in Haggai. Notice down in verse 20. And again the word of the Lord came unto Haggai in the 24th day of the month. So 3 days later. Speak to Zerubbabel, governor of Judah, saying, I will shake the heavens and the earth. Another prophecy about the shaking of heaven as well as earth. And I will overthrow the throne of kingdoms, and I will destroy the strength of the kingdoms of the heathen, and I will overthrow the chariots and those that ride in them, and the horses and their riders shall come down, every one by the sword of his brother. In that day, saith the Lord of hosts, I will take thee, O Zerubbabel, my servant, son of Shealtiel, saith the Lord, and will make thee as a signet, for I have chosen thee, saith the Lord of hosts. So this speaks about a day that's going to come, the shaking of heaven and earth, the day of the overthrow of the kingdoms. But what may be puzzling is that last verse, verse 23, where it speaks to Zerubbabel about how he will be made a signet and how he is going to be honored in that day. We could say that that does apply to Zerubbabel in the sense that he also is one of the resurrected. He will be given glory and honor personally and have a place in the kingdom. And so maybe this is to speak to him directly. But if you'll turn to Zechariah chapter 4, turn to Zechariah chapter 4. Haggai and Zechariah, again, were contemporaries. If you read verse 1 of chapter 1, Zechariah receives these initial visions in the 8th month in the 2nd year of Darius. And so the very next month after Haggai prophesied, now Zechariah is prophesying in the 7th month. So from the 6th month, Haggai prophesied to the 7th month, where Zechariah prophesies. And you'll notice in Zechariah chapter 4, he sees the lamps, the 7 lamps that we've spoken about before concerning this chapter. And then in verse 4, he says, So I answered and spake to the angel that talked with me, saying, What are these, my Lord? Then the angel that talked with me answered and said unto me, Knowest thou not what these be? And I said, No, my Lord. Then he answered and spake unto me, saying, This is the word of the Lord unto Zerubbabel, saying, Not by might nor by power, but by my spirit, saith the Lord of hosts. Who art thou, O great mountain? Before Zerubbabel, thou shalt become a plain. And he shall bring forth the headstone thereof with shouting, crying, Grace, grace unto it. Moreover, the word of the Lord came unto me, saying, The hands of Zerubbabel have laid the foundation of this house. His hands shall also finish it. Thou shalt know that the Lord of hosts hath sent me unto you. For who hath despised the day of small things? For they shall rejoice and shall see the plummet in the hand of Zerubbabel with those 7. They are the eyes of the Lord which run to and fro through the whole earth. So, again, obviously this is coming in the same time, in the same context where the children of Israel need encouragement because they started the building of the temple, but it's far from the glory that the older Israelites remember. And they need this encouragement to keep pushing on and to get the job done. Just like in Haggai 2, where it mentioned that the Spirit of God would be with them, so Zechariah 4, looking at the lampstand and the 7 flames, says, It's not by power or by might, but by my Spirit, saith the Lord, that this is going to happen. And then in verse 6, he speaks about Zerubbabel, verse 7. Who art thou, O great mountain? Before Zerubbabel, thou shalt become a plain, and he shall bring forth the headstone thereof with shouting, crying, grace, grace unto it. We could say that literally this does not happen in the time of Zerubbabel, that a mountain was ever made plain before him. Zerubbabel, in both of these passages, seems to be reflecting, be representative of the Davidic line, and therefore representative of Jesus Christ who is to come. When Christ does come back, the mountains will be brought low and the valleys will be raised up, and the land there shall be made a flat plain to prepare the way of the Lord and make his path straight, as Isaiah prophesies. And so it seems that Zerubbabel here is representative of Jesus Christ. And so when we take this back to Haggai chapter 2, and speaks about the shaking of the heavens and the earth, the mention of Zerubbabel there as well could very well refer to Christ as the signet ring upon his finger, and the one that he shall give glory to in that occasion. So we see both of these prophecies in Haggai, shaking of heaven and earth, do not need to be made figurative at all, but still hold their literal sense of the great prophecy and the changing of the earth yet to come. Let's turn in our psalm books to Psalm 48. Psalm 48. A. This is the psalm we read about, the praise of Jerusalem, as God makes it a glorious praise in all the earth. We read verse 1, great is Jehovah, and his praise should be proclaimed abroad within his hill of holiness, the city of our God. Mount Zion stands most beautiful, the joy of every land, the city of the mighty King. On her north side thus stands. Let's sing together Psalm 48a. Let's turn to Joel chapter 2. Joel chapter 2. Joel chapter 2, we see very clearly prophecies of the second coming of Christ. The particular passages we see the shaking of heaven come in Joel chapter 2, verse 10, where it says, the earth shall quake before them, the heavens shall tremble, the sun and the moon shall be dark, and the stars shall withdraw their shining. So, connection here between the shaking of heaven and earth and the sun, moon, and stars all being darkened on that day, which was what we see in the New Testament, all occurring on the day of the Lord. But then we also notice in chapter 3, verse 16, it says, the Lord also shall roar out of Zion and utter his voice from Jerusalem, and the heavens and the earth shall shake, but the Lord will be the hope of his people and the strength of the children of Israel. So again, shaking of heaven and earth there in relation to the Lord's second coming, as we'll see. In this prophecy of Joel, which it's not very clear to understand exactly the date when Joel prophesied, but he was dealing with some kind of a locust plague that was coming on the land, which was causing great misery and distress of the people, and God brought this on them for their sin and wickedness. But we notice how this locust plague then becomes something more and something futuristic, future to Joel, as it refers to the day of the Lord in chapter 2, where he says, blow ye the trumpet in Zion, and sound an alarm in my holy mountain. Let all the inhabitants of the land tremble, for the day of the Lord cometh, for it is nigh at hand. So a very clear reference to the day of the Lord, the second coming of Christ. Verse 2, a day of darkness and gloominess, a day of clouds and of thick darkness. As the morning spread upon the mountains, a great people and a strong, there hath not been ever the like, neither shall be any more after it, even to the years of many generations. So there is a great people that come in this time. Some have considered this to be the locus of chapter 1, but it seems to me at least that this is rather the resurrected army of Christ as it comes to defeat the nations at the Battle of Armageddon that we'll see more clearly in chapter 3. It says in verse 3, the fire devoureth before them. We see the fire of 2 Peter chapter 3, possibly in this fire. And behind them a flame burneth. The land is as the Garden of Eden before them, and behind them a desolate wilderness. Yea, and nothing shall escape them. The appearance of them is as the appearance of horses, and as horsemen so shall they run. Like the noise of chariots on the tops of the mountains shall they leap, like the noise of a flame of fire that devoureth the stubble, as a strong people set in battle array. Before their face the people shall be much pained, all faces shall gather blackness. They shall run like mighty men, they shall climb the wall like men of war, and they shall march every one on his ways, and they shall not break their ranks. Neither shall one thrust another. They shall walk every one in his path, and when they fall upon the sword, they shall not be wounded. Sounds like someone who has been made immortal and no longer able to die. Verse 9. They shall run to and fro in the city. They shall run upon the wall. They shall climb up upon the houses. They shall enter in at the window like a thief. The earth shall quake before them. The heavens shall tremble. The sun and the moon shall be dark, and the stars shall withdraw their shining. So, obviously connected to that day of the Lord and the second coming. And the Lord shall utter his voice before his army, for his camp is very great, for he is strong that executeth his word. For the day of the Lord is great and very terrible, and who can abide it? And then if we go down, let's jump down to verse 27. These verses we're going to recognize as very familiar because they're quoted by Peter on Pentecost when the Spirit of God came upon them and they were able to speak in tongues. But ultimately, these verses, though in part can be applied to that occasion, they ultimately have their fulfillment, yet future, when Christ returns and we are made filled with the Spirit perfectly in that time. So, beginning in verse 27, and ye shall know that I am in the midst of Israel, and that I am the Lord your God, and none else. And my people shall never be ashamed. And it shall come to pass afterward that I will pour out my Spirit upon all flesh. And your sons and your daughters shall prophesy, your old men shall dream dreams, your young men shall see visions. And also upon the servants and upon the handmaids in those days will I pour out my Spirit. And I will show wonders in the heavens and in the earth, blood and fire and pillars of smoke. The sun shall be turned into darkness and the moon into blood before the great and terrible day of the Lord come. And it shall come to pass that whosoever shall call on the name of the Lord shall be delivered. For in Mount Zion and in Jerusalem shall be deliverance, as the Lord hath said, and in the remnant whom the Lord shall call. And so, in connection with this coming of the Spirit and the great work of the Spirit in the millennium time, is also remembrance of the day of the Lord, with the sun and moon being darkened, and all the terrible events that happened at that time. So again, the shaking of heaven is very clearly in the context of the day of the Lord to come. And then as we move into chapter 3, it begins there. For behold, in those days and in that time, when I shall bring again the captivity of Judah and Jerusalem, I will also gather all nations and will bring them down into the valley of Jehoshaphat and will plead with them there for my people and for my heritage Israel, whom they have scattered among the nations and parted my land. So here we see another connection, the return of the captives of Israel in verse 1. That is part of the prophecies of that great day of the Lord. And then the nations are brought into the valley of Jehoshaphat to reason with them there. Ultimately, that is seen in the battle of Armageddon that happens in that valley, as we'll see in the rest of this chapter. If we go down to verse 9, it says, proclaim ye this among the Gentiles, prepare war, wake up the mighty men, let all the men of war draw near, let them come up. The words calling the people to the battle of Armageddon at the day when Christ returns. Beat your plowshares into swords and your pruning hooks into spears. Let the weak say, I am strong. Assemble yourselves and come, all ye heathen, and gather yourselves together round about. Thither cause thy mighty ones to come down, O Lord. Let the heathen be wakened and come up to the valley of Jehoshaphat. For there will I sit to judge all the heathen round about. Put ye in the sickle, for the harvest is ripe. We're going to see that refers to Revelation chapter 14, when Christ puts in the sickle for the battle of Armageddon to trample the grapes there in the winepress. It says, come, get you down, for the press is full, the fats overflow, for their wickedness is great. Multitudes, multitudes in the valley of decision, for the day of the Lord is near in the valley of decision. The sun and the moon shall be darkened, and the stars shall withdraw their shining. Again, the celestial lights on the day of second coming. The Lord shall roar out of Zion and utter his voice from Jerusalem, and the heavens and the earth shall shake. The shaking of heaven occurring on the day of the Lord, only that day. But the Lord will be the hope of his people and the strength of the children of Israel. So shall you know that I am the Lord your God, dwelling in Zion, my holy mountain. Then shall Jerusalem be holy, and there shall no strangers pass through her anymore. Revelation 21 and 22 clearly speak about how holy the New Jerusalem is, and how no wicked people will be able to come inside of her gates anymore. Verse 18, and it shall come to pass in that day that the mountains shall drop down new wine, and the hills shall flow with milk, and all the rivers of Judah shall flow with waters, and a fountain shall come forth of the house of the Lord, and shall water the valley of Shittim. We can say that is the river of life. Verse 19, Egypt shall be a desolation, and Edom shall be a desolate wilderness for the violence against the children of Judah, because they have shed innocent blood in their land. But Judah shall dwell forever, and Jerusalem from generation to generation. It is the eternal city from here on out. For I will cleanse their blood that I have not cleansed, for the Lord dwelleth in Zion. As we see in Revelation, he is enthroned in the midst of the city by this time. And so, again, we see that the Old Testament prophecy clearly speaks of the shaking of heaven and earth in the context of the day of Christ, which the New Testament confirms as well. One final passage, and unfortunately I don't think we should take too much time to look into it today, but I think we'll have other opportunities. Isaiah 13, verse 13 says, "Therefore I will shake the heavens, and the earth shall remove out of her place in the wrath of the Lord of hosts in the day of his fierce anger." If we were to look at chapter 13 and into 14, we would see that this is a prophecy against Babylon and against the king of Babylon. And here we find in it that the shaking of heaven and earth is mentioned. Later, we see that the Medes are mentioned. Verse 17, "Behold, I will stir up the Medes against them, which shall not regard silver, and as for gold, they shall not delight in it." But if you look at the passage as a whole, very clearly, I think, comes out the future aspects of Babylon. The Babylon of the book of Revelation, not the Babylon of Nebuchadnezzar or of those that were conquered by the Medes and the Persians back in that day. It is the future Babylon that presumably will be conquered by the Medes again as the kings rebel against that city, according to Revelation chapter 17 and following, and burn the city. And that is clearly what these chapters describe. One indication of that is that when the Medes were able to take the city, though they used violence to do so, it was pretty much a peaceful takeover. The city itself was happy to have the Medes deliver them from the Babylonian kings, which they had come to hate. That's not what's described here as far as the Medes conquering Babylon in Isaiah 13. They come and they burn the city, and it becomes a permanent desolation, here in Isaiah 13. The Medes did not make Babylon a permanent desolation. In fact, they came and inhabited the city and passed it on to the next kingdom, which had it for a time. And eventually, we have today Babylon that's been abandoned. The people chose to move out of Babylon and abandoned it in order to move to their present-day capital city of Baghdad, and thus it has come to great ruin because of that. So we may look at it today and say, well, that certainly shows a desolate city according to the prophecies. But Revelation's prophecies, I believe, still shall be fulfilled. It shall be revitalized, be made glorious, and one day shall be betrayed by the fellow kings of the Antichrist, burned on that occasion, and from then on will not be a permanent, will be permanently desolate. Again, we could spend more time going into chapter 14 with the king of Babylon. I think a description there of how the king of Babylon seeks to sit in the temple and to present himself as God, I think a great indication as we connect this to the New Testament, as Paul in 2 Thessalonians speaks about the Antichrist, the man of sin, sitting in the temple, declaring himself to be God, that the Antichrist is the king of Babylon. And those are connections that we will make as we move forward in Revelation. All that to say, when we read this in chapter 13, that the heavens shall be shaken, I think, again, this falls into the context of the future shaking of heaven and earth, and should not be considered part of the past in relation to old Babylon. So all this to say, again, that the Old Testament confirms what the New Testament declares to be true. There is only one more event where Christ will speak and the earth will shake, but not only the earth, but heaven itself. On that day, the sun, moon, and stars will be darkened. The stars will be shaken out of heaven. That will be the day when Christ returns, when we will be resurrected, when the captive Israelites will be called back to their home city of Jerusalem, when the nations shall be brought to submission under Christ's kingship and shall serve him at least for 1,000 years until they finally rebel and they're destroyed from the earth. Promises of God are sure. There is no inconsistencies in all of it. And we can have confidence that the kingdom of God is not here today. It is still waiting for that day when the heaven itself shall shake, and that has not occurred yet. And the new heavens and new earth will be brought forth, and then the capital city will come down out of heaven, and we shall be in the kingdom of Christ forever.